Gather round wizards, it's time to explore. A world full of magic, we're opening the door. With Dan and Jessica, we're here for the ride. On broomsticks and butterbeer, come along for the glide. Chapter by chapter, we're diving so deep through Hogwarts halls where the secrets creep. From the sorting hat to the wizarding fights, potions and spells and those magical nights. With our cups full of butterbeer, we analyze the lore, the friendships that blossom, the battles and more. Every word written we take with delight, bringing Harry's world back into the light. Broomsticks and butterbeer, let the magic flow. Join the discussion, there's so much to know.
Welcome back to another episode of Broomsticks and Butterbeer, episode 168. I'm Dan Rhino.
I'm Jessica Rhino.
We are continuing our journey through Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Today, talking about Chapter 6. But before we do that, since the last time we spoke, you and I went on a couple geeky trips.
So many geeky trips.
So, since mine came first chronologically... I'll let everybody know that Springfield, Missouri, at Missouri Comic Con a couple weekends ago was a hit.
Woohoo!
I presented, along with, I had Andrew working the ones and twos for me, working the soundboard, adjusting my levels, so I had felt like I had like a professional on the team. He told me something that, because I kind of wasn't expecting... You kind of caught me off guard when you went into like your announcer voice, because I was just talking to, hey everybody, how's it going?
That's not how you sound.
But he said it might have just been the dichotomy between the guy that spoke before me, who, I mean, I don't know this gentleman.
He's not a professional.
I don't know this gentleman. He had like four panels that weekend. About movies. He must be friends with the guys that run the show. But I mean, I think Andrew said it was kind of like being at a funeral.
Ooh.
I mean, there wasn't a lot of people like at his panel. I kind of felt bad for him. So when he got done, it was just like silence. And so I started clapping and then like five other people joined in for the clap. So I kind of thought that was my duty to help a brother out a little bit.
Yeah.
But then as soon as my panel comes, it's standing room only, baby.
We're very popular. I don't think you're very
popular. You're very popular. Somebody came up to me and said, "Where's Jess?"
Where's Jess?
I said, "Jess is deathly allergic to cats, and I like to stay with Andrew while I'm there."
Yeah.
I think it's be kind of weird to go there and stay in a hotel. But it was a really good show. It was really well attended. They had it at the Springfield Fairgrounds, which you're familiar with from your time at college there. Dog shows. Okay. I thought it was when you went.
We went to class at the country fair.
I thought maybe
grounds.
You went to the fairgrounds at some point in the year that you lived in Springfield.
Nope.
But
nope. Didn't know it existed until I went back to show dogs.
It was really kind of, they had like these permanent structures that were like, there was like a root beer fountain and there was like a taco place and there was like a police like outpost. And I guess they have those like up and running during like, I saw a lot of pictures of like, cow shows and cattle shows and stuff that they have there.
Yeah, that's not running when the dog shows are there either.
Yeah.
I don't know what they open for, but it's not the dog shows and it's not the comic book shows.
But we had a great day for it. Weather was perfect for it, but they had it in like two different buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually had to walk like not a long way. You know, you walk maybe 75 yards to 50 yards maybe to get from one building to the other, but it was beautiful outside, so there's no problem in doing that. And that allowed them to be able to have more vendors and more stages and more celebrity booths and stuff like that. And there was a a lot of vendors there, a lot more than I, the last time I went to the Springfield show, where it was at the convention center. But I thought they did, they put on a really good show. They put on, they, security was good. They were working their tails off, you know, checking bags and,
What?
You gave a weird look, like checking bags. What's that all
about? What's that? I don't know what this is.
The only hiccups we had were, and it didn't really affect us because we got there early, but it took a long time because you have to go by, like, past the Springfield Zoo to get to the fairgrounds. And I guess there was people coming to the convention center from both directions, but there's only one lane to feed in, and so it probably took us about 30 minutes to get onto the property and park and everything. But it's good that we did, because there were so many freaking cars there that when we left, you know, right before the show closed on Saturday, there were hundreds of cars parked in the grass.
Yeah.
And like some of these cars, like little sedans and stuff, parked at like the bottom of a ravine in the grass. I'm like, you might not get out.
You might not get out.
And if we get a drop of precipitation, you're definitely not getting out. But
And Andrew had flashbacks
to when he went to a dog show with you.
Yeah, that one was in Columbia.
20 years ago.
At the fairgrounds in Columbia. And it did rain a lot, and we got stuck. And there was a lot of mud, and we could not get my little tiny SUV. It was that Kia Sportage, the soft top one, like way back in the day. We could not get it out of the mud.
And that was also when Kia was making cars that like exploded at 100,000 miles. So they did not have a very good process down at that time. But I really enjoyed the show. I'd love to go back again next year. I thought it was, other than, you know, like food lines and stuff like that, which are some logistics things that they might have to figure out, they did a really good job of planning everything out. So credit to the people at Missouri Comic Con, and thanks for having us, and hope we'll get to come back in the future. And then you...
had a very different experience, Daniel.
Had a much different experience. You were
in
the Big Apple.
Went to New York City.
Yeah.
And I went to the very well-established lots of conventions center at the Javits yeah. Center. Lots of conventions there.
Yeah.
And it was run by Reed Pop, who does...
We have a lot of good experiences.
Lots of good experience. They do C2E2, we go to every year. Fantastic experience. They do New York Comic Con, which I've never been to, but
one of the biggest ones in the world.
One of the biggest, yeah. And I went to BookCon, and it was a mess.
So BookCon returned after like a five-year hiatus.
Yeah, 2019 was the last one.
Yeah, right around when the world ended.
There was one scheduled for 2020, but yeah, the world ended. And they just said, you know what? We're not doing it because of COVID, but we're also just not doing it anymore.
They did. They tried to do some kind of like virtual one for a couple of years, I thought. I vaguely remember that. Then I saw people talking about it online when people were complaining about the issues that they had with BookCon this year. And it was issues across the board from the very first minute that tickets went on sale months ago.
Back in October, they think they went on sale and they sold out within just a few minutes, and people got mad because it sold out then and normally didn't sell out.
And why
like
did
that.
It sell out? Because they,
you know what, Daniel, now I don't even know, because it used to be in the main convention center in the Javits, and then this year I guess it was going to be a rebuilding year. They were going to stick their toes in the water. They decided to have it at North Javits, which is the smaller side building. And so they sold less tickets, and it sold out instantly. But we do not know how many tickets. They never told us how many was in
that
initial run.
It's like a big mystery.
Run.
It's like when a soccer game
is
going to end.
There is no transparency. So they said, oops, well, it sold out. Great to hear that everybody loves it, but we are absolutely not going to sell more tickets. And then they sold more tickets.
So my theory.
Yes, sir.
My theory is, like you said, they were dipping their toes in the water, did not want to book the big part of Javits, and then, you know,
there's a lot of people going, oh, it was already booked. Well, then do it a different weekend.
They didn't, and they didn't want to not have the turnout that they would were hoping for, then end up having to take a bath on
the big building,
the money loss. So I think they booked the smaller one, thinking that, okay, well, we'll sell out of this eventually.
Sell 10,000-15,000 tickets.
You know, at some point. And then if it's successful, we can expand next year. And then when it sold out within minutes, they went, ooh.
Money. Well, they didn't immediately because they told us, I have the screenshot, that they had no, absolutely no intention of selling more tickets.
You know what happens sometimes, though, with big companies is they have a quarterly review. Mm-hmm. And if a quarter underperforms, then they panic and they try to make a change in the next quarter to try to right the ship. I'm thinking they had a underperforming quarter and said, well, what can we do to rebound? Because when the ticket's on sale and then when the event happened, we're not in the same time period.
No, no.
What can we do to rebound? Well, we know that there's a fervor for BookCon. They proved that to us by selling out within minutes. Even though we technically probably don't have enough room for them, let's go ahead and sell more tickets.
I'm wondering if they, because they told us it was going to be in North Javits, which it was, but they did have like a side, a room in the main Javits. So maybe they did get that extra, was able to secure that extra room. And it was by far the biggest room.
They gave the quilting convention a little money under the table.
Yeah,
to,
like, can we get your room?
One of your rooms?
Can we get one of your rooms, please? Please, just let us borrow it. That was the biggest room, but that was also the room that had one escalator down and one escalator up. And then on Saturday midday, the escalator up broke.
So we could probably do a whole episode about.
Oh, we will. We will. If you want to hear about it, the girls and I are going to do a podcast later.
The Book Cave podcast, available on all podcast platforms. It will, because you got, the cool thing about it is that you got to meet up with some of the inner circle.
Yes. A lot of the inner circle.
Catherine, Anastasia, and Jennifer all went to the
we
show
all
with
converged
you,
on New York
and
Kelly's
all
apartment.
Converged on Kelly's place. So you got to interact with a lot of the inner circle, but you actually got to experience the ups and downs of BookCon with your entire hosting staff on the Book Cave podcast. Mm-hmm.
So we will all be talking about it.
So give me two positives and your two top, I won't even say negatives, I'll say areas in need of improvement.
We all agree that the best run, the best part of BookCon was the bag check. Those people had it down. They moved us through. We did not wait. And considering that BookCon decided to let 25,000 people into the building all at one time, and the first place most of us went was bag check, they killed it. Mm-hmm. Like, I could not believe. Yes.
I only pressed it once.
It just kept going.
The people are really excited about security's performance at BookCon.
No, bag check.
Bag check.
Not security.
Oh, my bad.
Not security. Because they decided to let 25,000 people with bags, suitcases and backpacks in, and
so
security just went, go
not,
for it. Go,
not
go,
security?
Go. No, like check a bag.
Ah, to check a bag.
Sorry, I realized what I said. It, okay. Bag check, but
okay.
Like
I was assuming, like, hey, we need to look through your bag
no,
before you come in.
No, bag check, like give
so
give
coat
them
check.
Coat
like,
check,
like you give they get you give you, them
your
stuff,
stuff
they
and they give
you like
a little
a
ticket. Yep,
you throw them a couple bucks when you pick up your stuff.
Well, you got to pay $5 to check it.
Yeah, but like, got to yeah. Grease the palms a little bit.
They were going too fast. It would have burned up. So yeah, that was by far the best. Security, at least on Saturday, seemed to be non-existent. They were just waving everybody through. Sunday was better.
Probably because they realized what a predicament they were in.
Yeah.
If they would have actually performed security,
it would have taken like, for, listen, even longer.
You
want to
get in, or you want
to
be safe? Everybody's like, we want to get in.
That's what we thought. Go, 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 go. You're good. You're good.
So you said.
I said one good thing.
Coat check was positive.
Fantastic.
Thing.
That was Javits' crew, though.
Shout out to the Javits coat check department. If you're a listener,
not BookCon at all.
If you are, shoot us an email, broomsticks.butterbeer@gmail.com, and I'll send you some swag.
Yeah. What were the other things I was supposed to do?
I need two positives and two areas in need of improvement. So, coat check, positive. Give me one more.
Positive.
You shouldn't have to think this hard. You had fun. You said you had fun.
We all got into the ball because there was some drama leading up to it, whether or not.
So they had an after hours. Like,
they had an after hours fantasy ball. And that was included in your ticket. But then they sold more tickets. And the room where they're having the ball had a capacity. And they went, whoops, if you want to go, get there early. Because it's going to be there's going to be a capacity. And some people might not get in.
Now,
but
I thought you said that you spent 3 hours in line for a tarot card reading.
2 hours, sir.
And that's what you did at the fantasy ball?
That's what we did at the fantasy ball.
Okay.
And we didn't know. Right. We didn't know it was going to take. I know. No, the positive is everybody got in. Okay. Everybody who wanted to go got to go.
Okay.
And there were concerns about that, so I'm counting that as a positive.
Okay.
Areas of improvement.
Yeah, and from, can I guess?
go for it.
It sounds like it could all be summed up in kind of infrastructure. At the show, whether it is, I heard a lot of reports about bottlenecks being created, where lines were mismanaged and crossing into one another, and then you were stuck not even to get to the table or to get to the line, you were stuck in like a one-way traffic kind of situation, just trying to get out of the area that you were in. And it sounds like that could be fixed with maybe more aware staff directing where things should go.
No, it comes down to space. There was just no way. Okay. I don't care what kind of planning you did. You were not going to pull that off.
They just oversold for
in that little tiny room. I showed you the picture of the room upstairs. You said it looked like a hotel ballroom.
Yeah.
And that was ridiculous.
And that's not big enough for the crowds that they sold for.
In years past, we were in, you know, the big convention center part, you know, like at McCormick. It's that huge
Javits
open room.
Yeah, Javits is one of the bigger ones
just
in the country.
Endless amounts of mm-hmm. space in one room. Yeah. And they divided it all up into these little tiny rooms. And even when it used to be in the big, big space, they had issues with the lines. And when one year BookCon was in Chicago and was at McCormick, and I said they did it right.
Mm-hmm.
They put the big publishers, everybody wants to be like up front and in the center and whatever. No, the big publishers need to be around the outside and have space behind their booth where they can have queue lines.
Yeah.
And that's what they did it.
You need to treat them like you would a celebrity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have giveaways all day. Mm-hmm. They're going to have authors at their booth signing. There will be celebrities at their booth signing mm-hmm. stuff. So they need somewhere to queue these people up, give them a space, so the lines are not in the walkways. Because that's the problem. And then they're like, oh, you got to break the line and have the walkways clear. But then other people jump in line because mm-hmm. they don't see that the line is further down. It just gets to be a huge mess. But in that little tiny space this year, there wasn't even room for that. Like, it was just shoulder to shoulder people, and you're trying to form a line in the walkway. It just doesn't even work. Harry Potter?
And they're coming back next year, right?
That's what they said.
Yeah. And you're in a wait and see mode, or are you thinking that maybe
I think we're going to sit a year out.
Yeah.
And I in the survey, they asked how likely I would be to recommend BookCon to somebody else or to go back. And I said that we're going to wait and see, and you're going to have to prove that you can do it right before I'm giving you any more money.
Mm-hmm. Because fool me once, shame on me.
That was horrible.
Or fool me once, shame on you. you won't get fooled again.
It was like there was no one who had ever actually been to a book con on their planning committee.
Interesting.
Because anybody who had been to a previous one, you knew what the problems were with that one. You would have seen this was not going to work.
Well, hopefully they see it as a money-making opportunity, because the demand was obviously there. But if you want to have it as part of your portfolio and as a money-making venture going forward, you can't let your people, you can't let your customers down.
No, you can't make these mistakes. It wasn't even safe. It just wasn't safe.
Yeah. Harry Potter?
Harry Potter.
Last time we talked about Chapter 5, Fallen Warrior of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Recap that real quick. We had Hagrid and Harry barely surviving the escape from Voldemort and his goons. More members from the Order of the Phoenix show up at the Burrow. George Weasley has lost an ear due to a dark curse from Snape. But the worst news comes when we learn that Mad-Eye Moody was killed during the escape as a direct result of Mundungus Fletcher bailing on Moody. Harry explains the strange behavior that his wand had during the escape, and we learn that Ollivander, potentially the only one who could explain this phenomenon, is missing. And on top of everything else, we've got the wedding of Bill and Fleur to prepare for. So Chapter 6 today, The Ghoul in Pajamas.
My book had pajamas spelled weird.
How else would you spell pajamas?
There's a Y in it, apparently.
Those Brits, man. No wonder they lost the war to a bunch of farmers. 250th anniversary this year, Jess.
I was reading it. I'm like, the what? The what?
It's stuff like that. It's pretentious stuff like that. Putting extra U's in letters,
mm-hmm.
Putting Y's in pajamas.
Can't tolerate it.
And the food, awful. Awful. The food is awful in the United Kingdom. If we got any listeners over there, I apologize, but USA, USA. Despite all the terrible things we're doing
yes.
around the world. And don't judge us by...
We apologize for that, too.
Don't judge us by our representatives, either. A lot of moving parts in this chapter. The atmosphere at the Burrow is very strained. Everyone's still reeling from the permanent injury to George and the death of Moody. Plus the fact that no one could recover Moody's body. Security at the Burrow is super tight. Everyone is fully aware that Voldemort's rise to power is continuing. And on top of all that... Like I said, there's lots to be done to prepare for the wedding of Bill and Fleur. But this is also really the first chance in a while that Harry, Ron, and Hermione are able to discuss what's next for them, specifically their quest to destroy all of Voldemort's remaining Horcruxes. Mm-hmm. And we find out that Hermione and Ron have been doing a lot more planning for this quest than Harry has.
Harry's just like... I want to go back to where my old house was, maybe, and then see where we go from there.
So, let's start with Hermione. She has a Muggle family to worry about.
Yes.
What is the concern here for her family, and how does she carry out a plan for dealing with that?
So, I know I say this all the time when I start talking. I haven't read these books in a long time because I didn't do any rereads since we started doing this podcast. So that's been a while now. Mm. And I don't even know how many times I reread Deathly Hallows because it was the most recent book and I don't know. And a big one. But I did appreciate how it gets like thoroughly described here. Mm-hmm. Because in the movies, you know, they just kind of show her standing behind her parents.
Yeah,
and
it's like kind of like...
And you don't really know the nuances of it.
Kind of a memorable scene. And that was the first thing that popped into my head when she's talking. And I'm like, oh, that's not really how I remember
how
it.
How it went down. Yeah, so I really was like, oh, okay, I guess because I hadn't read this in such a long time, I kind of forgot about all this. And then the movie just kind of replaced it mm-hmm. in my head.
Plus, the movies are just on all the time.
Yes, but I don't watch them either since we
but
started.
Like, you might accidentally like catch some parts of the movie and then have them kind of seep into your brain yeah. and take
but
up residence
I
in
think
there.
That scene is just a powerful scene.
I think it is, too. Like, because even I remembered it.
Also, you're like, oh, it's the mom from Game of Thrones.
I got you.
Got some crossover references in there, too, that you. Make it more memorable. I got you.
So what is Hermione's plan here?
So she has it. She hasn't just like take in the movies. It kind of implies that she erased herself.
Yeah.
Because she like disappears out of the photos and she's taking the memories. She just erased herself and her parents never had a daughter.
Yeah.
But in here, she explains it a lot better. She has like altered their memories, changed their names, told them that it's their life ambition to go to Australia. They're going to go and move to Australia.
I think they've done it. I
yeah.
think she said they just
they're
did
gone.
It.
Yeah. They're gone.
And they and she thought that Australia would make it a little harder to find them because what is she worried about?
She's worried about if it gets out that she's helping Harry, that her family would become a target either to torture to get information about her or to like get her to come out of hiding mm-hmm. and give up information on Harry, something along those lines. So this way they're gone and hopefully it will just look like all of them upped and moved away. Like that she fled with her parents because lots of the muggle born students are not going back to Hogwarts and are just kind of fleeing.
Yeah, they mentioned that a lot of the muggle born kids are not going to be going back anyway just because of the dangerous predicament that they're in. Mm-hmm. But Hermione did make it sound like hopefully when this is all said and done, I can go to Australia.
Yeah. Find them.
Fix their memories and make it.
Yeah. Like
nothing happened.
It wasn't permanent.
Yeah.
But in the movies, it felt very permanent.
That's absolutely. Yeah. When I think about like how intense that scene was in the movie. And it was like, I'm saying goodbye to my parents forever, mm-hmm. you know?
And she doesn't know, like we get further into this. I'm not going to say they like fully expect to die, but they are aware that the percentage isn't good.
Yeah.
That they're going to make it out of this and then go back to their regular lives.
I get you.
So, I mean, on her end, she was kind of feeling this might be permanent, but it's not permanent the way we kind of thought it was from the movie.
I got you. I want to dig a bit deeper into Hermione's plan here because you can tell this was a very daunting task for her emotionally. Do you lean more toward this as like a selfless act by Hermione, or is it something ethically complicated about taking away the parents' choice in the matter?
I think it is complicated, but
are you gonna tell what you're gonna say what you always tell me? It's for your own good.
It's for your own good. I think it's just necessary. Sometimes you just gotta do what's necessary.
So you lean more toward it being a selfless act.
Selfless, but also at the same time, I feel like it was easier for her to not tell them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So a little less selfless. Like you're saying, if they'd had the conversation and she said, Mom, Dad, I need you guys to do this. I'm going to alter your memories. You see, we won't. Like if you sat down and had the conversation with them and said, this is what's going to happen. I need you to be on board with this. That I feel like that's a little bit, that would probably be a little bit better, but she, and I guess she doesn't say she didn't do it.
Yeah.
But again, we're feeling like the movie is filling in some blanks here that she did it without them knowing. And I feel like that is a little bit more selfish of a selfless act.
Mm-hmm.
Because she didn't have to have that conversation with them.
This chapter made me realize something that I think I've known all along but never really said out loud. Of Harry, Ron, and Hermione, this trio here, Hermione is the most dangerous member of this group.
She definitely is. I mean, when she knows she needs to figure something out, she just goes and figures it out.
I mean, she's the one willing to erase identities, plan everything. She can make cold decisions. She's proven that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Order might not see her this way, but she's one of the biggest weapons in the Order's arsenal because mm-hmm. of not only her ability as a witch, but also she's shown that she's not, you know, afraid to go into that morally gray area to make things happen and to get things done. It's got a lot of Slytherin in her.
Yeah.
You know, as far as just like that drive and that ambition.
Yeah. There's no way Harry could have done any of this, pulled any of this off, any of these, survived the years that he survived without mm-hmm. her. And that's what makes the trio so good. They all contribute.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say, though, I got a little annoyed with her in this chapter. And maybe they were trying to, like, make her a little more vulnerable. But it just felt like she was bursting into tears every 5 seconds.
Well, she's a hormonal teenager.
But that's not the character.
There's a lot going on.
We know from the movies. You know, there were a couple of times movie Hermione would like, okay, but she like sucked it up real quick.
Hermione would slap some sense into
yes,
book
I feel
Hermione.
Like she
suck
would.
Suck it up.
She might be fighting back her own tears, but she would slap the other Hermione and be like, get over it. Not like, get over it, but get yourself together.
So Ron's plan is even weirder.
Because it's Ron.
I know it was mentioned that lots of muggle-born students were probably going to be pulled from Hogwarts as a precautionary measure. So mm-hmm. that would explain why Hermione wouldn't be at school without raising suspicion. It seems a little convoluted, but I'll give it a pass. But with Ron, the thought is that people would find it fishy if he doesn't return to Hogwarts. So they need a plan for explaining that.
They just need him to be somewhere. Because if he's not at Hogwarts, then he's with Harry.
I need you to be somewhere.
I need
man.
You to be somewhere.
Just be somewhere.
So if he's not at Hogwarts, he's with Harry. But this way, they can say he's home and he's sick. And that takes the heat off his family.
So here's where we get to the namesake of our chapter, the ghoul in pajamas.
Pajamas. I don't know how to put pajamas. The Y in there.
Do all wizarding households have ghouls, or is this not a common thing?
I'm sure some do.
So how does a ghoul like function from day to day? Like, are they like the ghost at Hogwarts, where they like will occasionally like give you pertinent information, or are they like peeves, like always breaking stuff in the house?
This one's a ghost, but he's just kind of a lump. They said he can't talk.
So he just hangs out up in the attic and eats like...
He's like a mushy ghost.
Spiders and rats and stuff like that.
Ghosts don't need to eat.
What?
Ghosts don't need to eat.
Well, he's a ghoul, though. This is a ghoul.
Oh, okay.
This is a ghoul.
Isn't that a type of ghost?
Oh, I don't believe so. I thought a ghoul was like a deformed, like, monster kind of thing. Like Gollum.
Gollum?
From Lord of the Rings.
I don't know. I thought it was like a type of ghost, like a poltergeist.
You always say poltergeist like that explains like I'm not talking about a ghost. I'm talking about a poltergeist.
I've never said those
you
words
absolutely
in
said
my
those.
Life.
You absolutely have said those words before.
Never.
You absolutely have said those words before.
No.
Yes. Absolutely. Roll the tape back. If you can find a time when she said anything like that on this podcast, let me know. I'll send you some swag. But I definitely have heard those words from you. So I'm trying to figure out like what a ghoul's reason for being is. Like, Are they like pets? Do you have to like throw a raw steak up in the attic every few days?
Okay, so it says that a ghoul, there's no good definition. Some say it's like a grave robber who feasts on human corpses. Others' definitions are it's a type of demon or evil spirit that haunts graveyards and desolate places.
But did you look up like what the, in the Harry Potter universe?
No, I just looked up what an actual ghoul is.
So this says in Harry Potter, a ghoul is an ugly, slimy, buck-toothed creature that lives in wizarding attics or barns and feeds on spiders and moths. Classified by the Ministry of Magic as a XX, manageable / non-threatening beast, they're often tolerated as household pets. A notable named ghoul lives in the Weasleys' attic, playing a key role in Deathly Hallows.
Oh, yeah, that's this.
So, they resemble a somewhat slimy buck-tooth ogre. Generally harmless, but can make noise, groan, and moan, occasionally throwing objects around. The Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures has a ghoul task force that removes ghouls from houses that have been sold to muggles.
Oh, okay. That would be necessary.
So I guess if... But it doesn't sound like the wizard, you know, and witches that live in a house seem to mind it. It's kind of like, oh, that spider's not hurting anybody.
Yeah.
So the plan here, it's actually a family affair. I think Ron said that it was Mr. Weasley and Fred and George have been altering the look of the ghoul. And this is with Miss Weasley's knowledge, but maybe not her approval.
Yeah.
They've been slowly making the ghoul look more Ronish.
Yeah, vaguely Ronish. His red hair. But then they're also giving it the pustules so that you wouldn't be able to tell that it's him or not him. And to collaborate the story of him being sick.
So they're given these nasty pustules to this poor ghoul?
Yeah.
That's kind of mean.
He doesn't seem to hate it, though.
maybe his brain just can't.
He's going to get process. To come live in Ron's room.
Yeah, he seems excited about that. So he's definitely got something working up there.
Yeah.
So Ron shows Harry.
And he got pajamas.
This ghoul up in the attic that is wearing Ron's pajamas and kind of looks like Ron if he was caught in a horrible fire.
Yeah.
And he
smells really bad.
And didn't lose any of his hair. So the plan is to... Ron was going to go off
with Harry
and Hermione,
but they're going to say that he didn't go off with Harry.
Yeah,
no, Hermione is in Australia. Ron is homesick. We don't know where Harry went.
And if anybody comes looking for Ron, they'll see this pustuled mess in his bed that looks vaguely like Ron.
But they're not going to get too close because it's contagious.
They won't get too close. Okay.
It's like the Ferris Bueller mannequin.
Yeah.
When you open the door.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about. So, yeah, Hermione's plan is kind of like...
Ron's Ferris Buellering it.
Yeah, Hermione's plan is kind of like, oh, this is what I did. And Ron's like, all right, here are the 80 steps we did. And how the next 80 steps are going to play out.
Hermione's was extremely complicated, too. She had to come up with fake identities for her parents. Like in passports and stuff. How else did they go to Australia? Well, she had to forge documents, legal documents.
Yeah, you're right.
She just didn't. Say it as complex.
It's all super weird. But it really reflects like how cautious and strategic Ron and Hermione are and how invested they are in this quest. Like, even though Harry still isn't fully on board with them going with him.
Yeah, and that was a fun part where he was like, okay, listen, guys. And they're like, shut up.
Like,
he's going to do it.
You haven't done anything. Like, Hermione's getting books ready. We might need these books. Like, we might have to translate runes you know, I better take this rune book. Mm-hmm. You were just going to go.
She said she's been packing so that they would be ready to leave at a moment's notice. Like, she's already ready. She's still doing more work, but if they had to leave right that second, she'd be like, all right, let's go. I've got everything.
And the three of them don't even know where to start with the Horcrux journey, but even though their plan is overall kind of vague, the commitment is very firm. Mm-hmm. Someone who, like I said, is not totally on board with the plans is Molly Weasley. Seems like every time...
would your mom be?
Every time... yeah, she would not be okay with it. I think there was a brief time where... I think it was Andrew was talking about joining the military.
Oh.
And she was like, absolutely not. No. She put the kibosh on that real quick. It seems like every time she sees Harry, Ron, and Hermione talking to each other, Molly figures they're plotting something dangerous and tries to come up with wedding preparation jobs to keep them apart.
This totally, again, reminded me of your mother and the graduation parties.
Mm-hmm.
It just reminded me of that.
I got you.
Where?
Go ahead. People don't have any idea what you're talking about.
Sorry. You graduated from college,
uh-huh.
and your brother graduated from high school
uh-huh.
at the same-ish time.
Same. It was same year. Yeah.
So your mom had to have this huge soiree at her house, and like the cleaning list was endless. The stress,
mm-hmm.
just the crazy things. Like, she was making Ron clean his room, and she's like, he's like, are they getting married in my bedroom?
Like, is anybody at any point going to see my room?
It just reminded me of that.
So, like I said, Molly is not on board with any plans that the trio have, and she's trying to get one of them to tell her everything. And anytime any member of the order asks, Harry will just say, well, Dumbledore only told me to tell Ron and Hermione, and they back off. If Dumbledore said that, then we're with it. But that doesn't work for Molly.
No.
So a couple questions here. Question one, keeping secrets like Harry, Ron, and Hermione are doing might protect people, but it also removes anybody's ability to help. So are Harry, Ron, and Hermione making the right choice here in honoring Dumbledore's wishes?
Yeah, I read the rest of the book. It worked out.
It seems like we can't even tell Lupin. Like the most trusted of the trusted? Does Dumbledore not want the more people that know, that's the more people that could be tortured to get it out of them? Or,
well, I think at the moment Voldemort doesn't know that anybody else knows. He doesn't know that they're slowly, methodically trying to destroy the whole cruxes.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the more people that know, that then it's going to get out or become more obvious with more people looking. Also, it's more of a threat if adults are doing it. If the whole Order of the Phoenix is looking for Horcruxes, Voldemort's gonna be like, oh, I gotta shut this down. But some kids, not quite as threatening. Also, we don't really know what they're doing. Oh, they're just kids. And they're gonna think, oh, he just went into hiding. Like, Voldemort's full of himself enough to think maybe Harry just went into hiding. Oh, I finally scared him. He's gonna go hide in a hole somewhere.
My second question is, Molly is trying to shield Harry, Ron, and Hermione from danger and keep them focused on normal life things with all these chores. Is Molly really protecting them, or do you think she's holding them back?
I think she's trying to keep herself together.
Like, so you think it's more about just keeping herself sane than...
There's a degree.
I'm doing everything I can to not have them leave this house.
Yeah, she wants to protect them, of course. But she, I think, is realistic to know that that whatever it is still needs to get done. Maybe by keeping them around longer, they'll eventually cave and tell other people what's going on. I don't know if she really thinks that. I feel like she just wants to keep things as normal as possible.
And I guess
and as busy as possible to distract herself, to distract them.
I guess when you think about it, too, I mean, Percy's already out of her life.
Mm-hmm.
Bill's about to get married and go away. George almost died
mm-hmm.
a couple days before this.
Not all of them, but Fred, George, and Ron, and Arthur were all in, like, mortal peril.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bill was there, too. So,
yeah,
you know, she almost lost several.
And, I mean, and Bill's been permanently scarred, too.
Mm-hmm.
So she's almost lost him a couple of times. It's almost like I'm going to keep them here under my roof as long as I can. And there's some of these things I can't control. I can't keep Bill here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's already going to, it's already been decided. He's going to go get married and, you know, start a life somewhere in the middle of a wizarding war. But I can sure keep Ron here, you know.
And I don't know if she really thinks she can keep him there, but maybe she can prolong it. Or yeah. maybe she.
That's kind of what I meant, for as long as I can.
And pretend things are normal while we do it. Or, you know, she's just kind of throwing herself so fully into this wedding that she can almost pretend that there isn't a war going on, that her other, you know, youngest son isn't threatening to leave on some secret quest, you know.
Yeah, my mom definitely was not a fan of her kids moving out of the house.
No.
Like, it, ideally, we would all still be living there. All five of her kids would still
there
be living there.
There was a point where she was trying to get us to buy that house down the street.
Mm-hmm.
The one that, like, somebody died in or something.
Yeah, get a good,
like,
deal.
No.
But yeah, I think she would. She's got, my mom is Molly Weasley. And I told that to the people in Springfield, by the way, that our mom was Molly Weasley.
I think she does surprisingly well with so many of you guys so far away.
Because
mm-hmm. really, it's just you and Bill that are left here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody else is, I guess, Andrew would be the closest at 3 hours away.
Yeah. Maybe, and he's technically still in the state.
3.5 hours away.
Yeah.
Jake is 5 hours away, and Sarah is 13 hours, something like that away by car. Security measures are mentioned throughout the chapter, but even with all the spells and enchantments, there's this feeling that nowhere is truly safe anymore. Even somewhere like the Burrow, which has, like, traditionally been a place of warmth and love and safety. We do get to meet Fleur's parents. Well, what can you tell us about the Delacours?
Well, I listened to the audiobook, so I got some fun, like, voices.
Give me the voices.
I don't remember the voices, but it pretty much didn't give us a whole lot. It said that Dad was not attractive.
Yeah, yeah. He's
he's short and...
He's a very homely looking
round
gentleman,
and
apparently.
Pointy beard. But very nice and outgoing. He seemed very warm.
Uh-huh.
His greetings and hugs and kisses. And so, Mom seemed pretty cool. Like, you kind of were like, oh, we kind of get that Fleur stuck up.
Yeah.
Although she's not, but she is.
Yeah.
And so you worry about Mom.
I was totally surprised by several things with this family. Number one, I was expecting super snob based on Fleur.
Mm-hmm.
I was expecting them to be super snobby. Not snobby at all. They were, like, willing to help clean up. They were willing to help with the wedding prep. They did not want to take Mr. and Mrs. Weasley's bedroom from them.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. and Mrs. Weasley insisted.
I'm surprised they couldn't, like, set up a tent outside that, you know, and that sounds awful, but a tent like they had at the Quidditch World Cup.
Sure.
That was very fancy and nice. Like, why couldn't we have the tent in the front yard at the Burrow? Because it seems very crowded.
So Dad must be, like, a really funny guy. Because somehow Dumpy Dad got a Vila mom or a Vila wife.
A half. Didn't she say her grandma was Vila?
Yeah.
I think it was grandma.
Apparently just gorgeous, though.
Yes.
So he must have a great personality.
Had Arthur giggling.
Yeah. He must have a great personality. Yeah, a lot of things about her parents really kind of caught me off guard, but I was pleasantly surprised. The thing that really, really stood out to me in this chapter, though, is how Ron and Hermione their alignment and their support of Harry has not wavered at all. And their partnership actually feels more mature and more purposeful than it ever has at any point in the story. Because when they talk, they don't talk about school anymore. It's about survival. It's about secrecy. It's about responsibility. It's like the tone of the friendship has shifted to reflect the gravity of their situation, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
And really, given all they've been through, it's kind of surprising that it hasn't shifted this way sooner.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to hold on to like the light kidness for a while. I mean, yes, some major stuff happened recently that has forced it to shift, but I just feel like could have shifted sooner.
Even when the Dark Lord was in the back of the guy's head in the first they just went on being kids things. After that.
Okay, who cares?
Before we wrap up the chapter, I want to do a couple pick-a-side questions with you. I'm going to give you a couple of choices here, and you have to pick one. You have to pick one. No offense. No offense. Is that what I sound like?
No. You have to pick one.
You have to pick one. It's not what I sound like. You can elaborate as much or as little as you want.
Backstories?
If you want to. If you want to. Or you can just give me an answer.
Okay.
All right. First one. Choice A. Harry shows true bravery by trusting Dumbledore's plan and stepping into the unknown. Choice B, Harry is dangerously passive, accepting a vague mission without questioning its lack of structure.
I'm going to go with A, but because...
Here comes the fence riding.
No, I'm just... My explanation is going to be like... Dumbledore kind of has a cult following.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Everybody's just 100% buying into what Dumbledore... It's not just Harry.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Like you said in the chapter, as soon as Harry said, nope, Dumbledore said, just me.
And they're like, all right.
They're like, okay.
Well, let the kids Dumbledore's
do what
they
got
want,
his
then.
Reasons.
Let the teenagers do whatever they want.
So, I don't think that it's, Harry's fault... Or that Harry's just like, oh my god, he's so brave, he's just gonna do this. Or that he's blindly following Dumbledore, although he is. That's the cult they're in.
Yeah.
It's a cult following.
My next one. Choice A. Keeping plans hidden protects allies from danger and interrogation. Choice B. It also prevents collaboration and weakens their chances of success.
I'm going to go with A, but it's, for me, it's more the need for secrecy.
Gotcha.
Like, I think that with just the three of them looking, it's not going to get out that they're looking and actively destroying these whole
The crisis. Secrecy is more important than the actual help that they would get out of it, the positives.
Well,
the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
We have already had multiple times where secrets have gotten out.
Leaky leakies.
This is just the three of them. Nobody else can know. Because if Voldemort knows, then he's going to go get one of his Holocruxes and keep it protected. And then what are they going to do? They can't go at him straight on when he's got Holocruxes. They can't win.
Yeah.
So the need for secrecy is the top priority here.
Gotcha. Choice A. The trio is emotionally ready. Which matters most in crisis situations. Choice B, They are tactically unprepared and heading into disaster without enough knowledge. I know you already know how things turn out, but...
I think I'm still going to go with A, although I did want to shake Hermione.
Okay.
Because you said emotionally ready. Like, she is, but she's also having some problems.
She just needs a little backhand to snap her back.
I mean, if she's going to have her little breakdown moments, I guess now's the time to do it. Get yourself together, because you got to save the world.
Last one. A, Ron Weasley brings emotional grounding and normal human hesitation that keeps the group balanced. Choice B, Ron Weasley is the least prepared and least essential member of the trio at this stage. I see the little hamster wheel turning in your head.
I'm like literally moving my hands too.
Maybe play the Frederick Roofing jingle and give you a chance to think.
Well, then I'm just going to sing along and I'm not going to.
Frederick Roofing.
Frederick Roofing, 645-3000.
B, but not that harsh.
This is called dead air.
Sorry.
It's really bad.
B, but not quite that harsh.
Okay. Interesting.
I think he is important, but I do think he needs to grow into the role a little bit still.
So at this stage, probably still has some improvements that need to be made.
He thinks he knows what he's getting into, but he don't know.
I got you. So would you say that he is, of the three, the least prepared?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's like kind of without question.
I mean, Harry's done nothing, but he has experiences in life or death situations, and he just has a little bit more.
Yeah, he's more of a natural experience. Yeah, and he's more of a natural wizard, you know, just like, some people can just pick up a new sport and they're immediately at least competent at it because they're just natural athletes.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also say that he's probably, if you had to rank them, probably the least essential member of the trio at this stage. But that's when you look at all of them as individuals. I think if you look at them as a team, like you mentioned earlier, they all bring something to the table.
Yes.
And that's why you could have, we've sent, like in Team USA basketball, we've sent our best players before, the best NBA American players that we have, and we don't win gold. So how do we
lose? They're not a team. They're just individuals.
They're not a team. Exactly. If they were playing one-on-one against other people from other countries, they would probably cream them. But you're playing against countries who, like, you know, if you, like, I remember, like, Lithuania or something like that in the 90s. They had been playing together since they were, like, 13 years old. And they're all in their mid-20s now. Mm-hmm. So they knew everything about each other's game. Whereas if you just take 12 great individuals and throw them together with, like, a month of practice, they're not going to be as good.
Mm-hmm.
These three would all take a bullet for the other three, to pardon a phrase. They all have different yins to the other one's yang too, and there's an emotional connection there, mm-hmm. and there's something to be said for that,
which she shows us in the chapter too, where Harry started to get on up on his soapbox and say, you guys don't have to go with us. And they shut him down because they already knew what he was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
That just shows how well they know each other.
I think that's all I got in my notes for chapter 6. Anything you want to add before we get to an email today?
Nope.
This email was sent to us, broomsticks.butterbeer@gmail.com, from Sarah in South Carolina.
Hi, Sarah.
She writes, hi guys, I was reading a Reddit thread where the question was asked, is it ever justified to use unforgivable curses if the enemy is evil enough? I leaned toward no, but then thought differently when I think about putting myself in a situation where I have to protect the people that I love. Where do you fall in this debate, and why do you think good characters were written to specifically not use these curses? So where do you fall on the, is it ever justified to use unforgivable curses if the enemy is evil enough? Let's tackle that one first.
I am going to say yes.
I think so too.
I know when we watch shows or movies or books, sometimes I get so frustrated with the main characters when they don't eliminate the threat and let them,
Batman
like,
just needs to throw run the away Joker off a
and
roof.
then they come back and kill somebody you love almost every time.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, well,
Maybe we'll put them in the Arkham again. This will fix them this time.
Yeah.
No, they're going to get out. They're going to kill people to get out. Then they're going to kill more people. And we're just going to, it's going to be rinse repeat. Like how many, I understand the idea of the character of like Batman having like a code that he follows. But at some point, man.
At some point. it's the same thing. She specifically said evil enough. Like,
yes,
if they're not redeemable, it's just they're not redeemable.
Yeah.
And like you said, they're just going to keep killing more and more and more people.
But I mean, there's that argument in our world too. Like some people that are gung-ho about the death penalty, and some people that are like, no matter what you did and how horrific you did, or the thing that you did, is nobody deserves to be put to death. You could rot in jail for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And some people think that's actually more of a punishment.
That's the difference between the real world and a fantasy, make-believe, you know, fiction world. We can contain them.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Most
they're not
the time,
getting
yeah.
out and causing bad things again.
Yeah.
Rare occasion, somebody, I guess, gets out of jail, breaks out or whatever.
It's rare.
But they're going to go hide.
Yeah, it's rare.
They're not generally going to go cause more problems.
Yeah, it's usually when they get pardoned by the president.
Oh.
Hold on, what do I got here? Oh, I saw the drum. I thought it was going to be a didum-tsh.
Well, what?
What's happening?
Yeah. Usually they get pardoned by the president and they go out and do something else and get thrown back in jail. But, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, nobody stays in Arkham for very long.
No. Or,
even
I don't
like
even...
superhuman prisons and stuff. That's a story tool to allow them to be able to be held for a little while before they get out and start more drama.
There was some show. It was a dystopian show. I think we called it the Xbox show. To have that weird symbol or something. I don't remember what the show was. But
Xbox show.
Oh my god, she was like, I'm not gonna shoot you, but I don't ever want to see you again or whatever. You know, she gives him the chance to walk away and she doesn't kill him.
Uh-huh.
And he like immediately kills her brother. And I'm like, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
He has been trying to kill y'all the whole 10 episodes.
Now I'm really thinking what this Xbox show
was. I feel like it had that little... It got really dumb. It ended up having like nanobots that got in people's brains or something.
Now this is sounding more familiar.
It was dystopian.
Uh-huh.
And it was like... I know the guy who was like the bad guy. He's in other things, but you know, I don't know celebrity names, so
no,
I can't tell
not.
You who that is.
Yeah, gun to your head, you'd be dead. You're like, just shoot me. I'm not going to know their names.
I don't know their names.
Do it, you coward.
Yeah. Like, because the lights went out. That was like the big thing. All the power went out.
Yeah.
And then it was America, and as all the power went out, and yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody is screaming at us right now.
I know. They're going to.
Because they know exactly what
first
show.
First one to email it in, you get some swag.
because
broomsticks.butterbeer@gmail.com.
They know exactly what show I'm talking about.
I'm starting to develop.
Did she have to go rescue her mother?
I'm starting to develop a picture in my head, but I've watched so much dystopian stuff over the years that sometimes all kind of
it started together. Out really good. We really enjoyed it, and then it went off the rails, and we were like, okay, we're done.
Oh, no. It was on NBC, I think.
I don't know.
I think it was. Oh, man. And I think it only lasted like 2 seasons, because I think the second season just got so weird that everybody kind of tuned out like we did.
Yeah.
Oh. I can see it in my head now. We're not going to waste any more time.
Okay. What was the second part of the question?
To think about it. Sorry about that, folks. Where do you fall? Or you already told where we fall in the debate. Why do you think the good characters were written? The good, in air quotes, characters, assuming there's good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
The good characters were written to specifically not use these curses.
I think it's exactly what you said. You want to have that line between mm-hmm. good and evil.
But although, all of the good characters seem to have that line.
Yeah, but I mean in the world.
Right.
You want to have that line in the world that there are good people and there are bad people. Mm-hmm. And this is,
and
like,
good people have this code where they follow with honor.
But there's a whole thing about it. Harry uses them.
Yeah.
So,
like, in a fit of rage, he didn't connect with any of them.
He controls somebody later.
Okay.
Like I don't think I was on Reddit, but maybe I was. I know she said she was on Reddit, but there was like a whole thing I was reading recently about, can Harry really be a good character, hero character, because he does use the unforgivable curses.
Mm-hmm. Not the killing curse, but the,
he tried to use the killing curse. He couldn't do it, but he did try.
Yeah.
And that's got to count for something too. Yeah, sure. Like,
the intent was
killing
there,
somebody,
but the,
because you were enraged.
Yeah. Isn't the intent
quite
was there,
the
but
same
you didn't
as
have
killing
the emotion
somebody
behind it to power the spell.
In a planned murder, but it's still, you were trying to kill somebody.
Sure. I understand that. So you think it's more of just the storytelling. They used to call them in like cowboy movies, white hats and black hats.
Yes. But I think, I don't know why, what world thing, but it's not as common now. Now you want, it's particularly in like the books I read, you want morally gray characters. Mm-hmm. They're more interesting to read.
You know, I'm going to bring it back to, I always got to bring it back to pro wrestling.
Pro wrestling.
When I was growing up, you had
Mark
clear cut good guys and bad guys.
Yes.
But when was wrestling the most popular that it ever has? You could probably identify like the year gap I'm thinking of here.
Yeah. The, like, 1998
exactly
to 2005.
Exactly.
I'm going to go with those years.
Yeah. Definitely like 90. I was going to say like 97 to 2001. So you're right,
okay,
in the same ballpark that I'm thinking.
I didn't know
of
where it started or where it ended, but I knew where it was.
And when that was its most popular, it's when you had these morally gray characters. When mm-hmm. you had Stone Cold Steve Austin, the biggest good guy in wrestling at the time, flipping people the bird and, you know,
drinking beers
and beating up his boss.
Yeah.
You know, that's when it became the most popular. Oh, we got a soccer start
tonight.
Oh, we gotta wrap this up then.
Oh. It'll be on for a while.
We've absolutely got to wrap this up. But yeah, that's there was kind of like this societal shift at mm-hmm. that time. And, you know, wrestling usually reflects society at the time for good or bad, you know, going all the way back to the 40s, you know, when we had like the bad guys were like the German characters that would. And then we had in the late 80s, early 90s, it was the foreign menace characters that, you know, you'd have like the Russian character was the bad guy and the Saudi Arabian sympathizer was the bad guy. There was like a societal shift around that time where you were seeing it in books and you were seeing it in movies, you know, like the good guy, like the anti-hero, the rise of the anti-hero, mm-hmm. and the rise of like the vigilante character, like the Punisher character became real famous, real popular in the 90s because he would, what would he do to the bad guys? He'd kill them. Mm-hmm. You know, he wouldn't take them to jail. That's why they had to kill off Superman in the 90s because the Goody Two Shoes Boy Scout character wasn't selling mm-hmm. anymore. So I think that's, you know, kind of in the late 90s, we had this worldwide shift in good and bad guys moving into like a morally gray area. And you say you see that in, saw that, started seeing that in literature too around
yeah,
that time.
Yeah, it's, I don't, I can't think of a single book that has just straight up
yeah.
halo wearing
yeah.
main characters.
That's right.
You want that morally gray. You want
flawed. For sure. Yeah, we've talked about that before.
I mean, maybe some of like, I read a lot of YA and some of, that's a big range. Mm-hmm. So maybe some of them on the younger side. But, you know, Throne of Glass is like my favorite series ever. And she's an assassin.
Yeah.
Like,
you're rooting for the assassin.
You're rooting for the assassin. And she has very good qualities and she does have morals. Mm-hmm. Like, she prefers to assassinate people who are bad, but mm-hmm. she is an assassin.
Mm-hmm.
And
There was, I don't know if you've ever seen the show Dexter, which is, he is the main character who you root for is a serial killer. But his dad taught him at a young age, you've got this demon inside of you. You need to kill. Let's channel that. And you only kill bad guys.
Bad guys.
You know, people who do horrible things. People who the world is better off without them in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to use this horrible urge that you have for good. But you're still rooting for a killer. For a serial killer
yeah.
in it, you know? But that's what people want. That's what people want to experience. That societal shift started, you know, 30 years ago.
I think it's easier to believe. I mean, maybe not that.
Yeah.
The demon in them and serial killer. But
no, but when I said demon, he didn't have like, it wasn't like a
actual demon.
Yeah, it wasn't like a demon from Hades or anything like that. It was like I think he called it his dark passenger.
Yeah.
This like this thing inside of you that makes you want to, like this urge inside of you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so many, I mean, that's kind of come with like more people being like diagnosed bipolar and, you know, more people being diagnosed with depression and suicidal tendencies, you know, in the last 30 years than when we were growing up.
But I also think perfect main characters, you can't associate.
You can't relate to them.
You're it's almost like discouraging. Like, who is that perfect? Nobody's that perfect. I could never be that perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But a character who does some bad things once in a while because they're in a tough situation, but they mean well ultimately, mm-hmm. you can get behind that. You can want to be like that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why there's, in my experience, I could probably count on one hand the number of Superman comic arcs that I have read that I really enjoyed. He's such a hard character to write because he's so perfect,
mm-hmm.
and everything comes so easy to him. And it should come so easy to him because of how overpowered he is.
The only thing that like doesn't come easy to him is like being human, and that's not something you can relate to.
Yeah.
You know what
I'm doing just fine at being a human.
Yeah. Great.
Just get it together, Supes.
Like, I just want to be normal like you guys. I don't know how. It's like, oh.
But I think that's why I enjoyed the most recent movie more so than the one that came before that, because they were able to kind of make that humanity shine through a little bit more and make him a little bit more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people hated it for that reason.
They did.
They were like, well, Superman should be able to just do this, this, and this. okay, well, then the movie's over in 20 minutes. Yeah. That's what you want?
But no, he's trying to balance. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And when you said that earlier about characters being written to be good and have a moral code and not being allowed to kill.
Yeah.
And then one of you started with Batman, but then you went over to Superman. I was like, well, no, Superman absolutely can't kill because he is so much more powerful. Like, Batman's just a dude.
Yeah.
Like, that would... The fact that he doesn't kill does make him better. But Superman, like, no, you absolutely cannot kill because you're so much more powerful than all the humans. Mm-hmm. It would then make him a bad guy.
Well, what does he do at the end of the Henry Cavill Man of Steel movie? His biggest enemy is about to kill innocent people, and he mm-hmm. snaps his neck. And I hated that.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't save his dad earlier in the movie, mm-hmm. you know, from the tornado. Because, well, we couldn't possibly have anybody see that you have powers. You know, so I'm going to let my dad die or my Earth dad die. I don't know. I like, you know, the ones who show that they have emotional weaknesses.
Yes.
More so. And have that kind of go along with, you can have that kind of go along with your moral code. But you can't be all powerful and have a moral code as well, if that makes sense. I don't know. I think I'm kind of mixing a lot of metaphors here, and it's kind of coming. It's kind of becoming like
as mushy as a
ghoul's face. But
ooh.
But yeah, I think that our points make sense, but we kind of took the scenic route to get there.
That's the best route.
And people are ready to just be done with this podcast because we're an hour and 15 minutes in. And the first 20
absolutely
minutes we talked
not.
About
they
trips.
Love us.
They went on vacations that we went on. So thanks, Sarah.
Yeah.
Thanks for emailing in. Appreciate it. She's like, I'll never do it again.
No.
And if you guys.
She's going to ask, if she does, it'll be like a simple yes or no question.
And the first person to think of that show, email it in, broomsticks.butterbeer@gmail.com, and I will send you some fun stuff. I think that's gonna be it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're really just finishing like just finish with strong. A fervor here. Special thanks to our inner circle, some of which you got to see in person recently. Jennifer, Catherine, Amelia, Jane, Ronnie, Anastasia, Kelly, Olivia, Jenny, and Emma. Jenny just had a birthday, and Ronnie's got a birthday coming up.
Okay. I thought they both had a birthday.
Ronnie's is within 24 hours of us recording this episode. By the time this episode is out, it will be her birthday, most likely, or within several hours of it.
Okay.
So, happy birthday, belated. Maybe early, maybe right on time to members of the inner circle. Thanks to you guys for downloading, listening, and subscribing. I loved, I got to meet some listeners in Springfield, which was awesome, even though some of them were disappointed that they didn't get to see you.
Sorry.
We really appreciate you guys following us on this journey, and it's been, quite a experience over the last we're closer to 10 years than we are 0 years in recording this podcast. So thanks everybody, all listeners, new and old. We appreciate you coming along on this journey with us. You can follow us on all podcast platforms. You can download, listen, and subscribe on all podcast platforms. You can follow us on our social media platforms, that being Twitter/X, at Broomsticks B, Instagram at Broomsticks B Podcast, at Broomsticks B on Blue Sky. And we are on Facebook as well, where you can send us messages there. Jess really likes getting messages on Instagram, though.
Yeah.
Because she's the one who controls that. It makes her feel special and important. So send her a message on there if you so choose, and you can brighten up her day a little bit. When you remember to check. You're like, I sent a message 3 weeks ago.
Sorry.
You never responded. But thanks for downloading, listening, and subscribing. Until next time, be a wizard, be a witch, be a muggle, be a squib, but don't be a jerk.
Or a git.
See ya.
Bye.
Gather around, wizards. It's time to explore a world full of magic. We're opening the door with Dan and Jessica. We're here for the ride on broomsticks and butterbeer. Come along for the glide. Chapter by chapter, we're diving so deep through Hogwarts halls where the secrets creep. From the Sorting Hat to the wizarding fights, potions and spells and those magical nights. With our cups full of butterbeer, we analyze the lore, the friendships that blossom, the battles and more. Every word written we take with delight, bringing Harry's world back into the light. Broomsticks and butterbeer, let the magic flow. Join the discussion, there's so much to know. With Dan and Jessica, let your spirit fly. In the wizarding world, we'll always reply. From the Quidditch games to the dark magic's call, we'll take on each chapter, seeing how they enthrall. Hermione's wisdom, Ron's loyal fight, we'll discuss every twist, make the dark turn bright. With an open heart and a curious mind, we'll unlock the secrets that are waiting to find. So grab your broomstick and settle in tight. It's time for the journey we're starting tonight. Broomsticks and butterbeer, let the magic flow. Join the discussion, there's so much to know. With Dan and Jessica, let your spirit fly. In the wizarding world, we'll always reply. Through the pages we wander side by side. In every adventure, we take it in stride. The laughter and lessons, the love and the pain. With each chapter shared, we'll never be the same. Let's raise our glasses to the stories we share. In the world of Potter, there's magic everywhere. From Diagon Alley to the Forbidden Forest, exploring this universe, we're never the worst. Every twist and turn, oh, it makes us feel the power of friendship, that's the real deal. So don't miss a moment, let's savor the fun. With broomsticks and butterbeer, the magic's just begun. So here's to the chapters, both old and new. With every spell cast, a world that feels true. On broomsticks and butterbeer, we'll see you next.